Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. News commentators are saying that Donald Trump is doubling down on his comments about immigrants coming over the border from Mexico. That is wrong. He has tripled down, now saying immigrants are pouring tremendous amounts of infectious diseases into the U.S. Joining us online for his take on this and other medical, ethical, and factual issues is Art Kaplan. Art is head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center, also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics podcast, and he's just been named among the 100 most influential people in biotechnology by Scientific American, which is amazing because so was I. Art, congratulations and welcome to the club.
Actually, the problem is I don't rank among the most 100 influential people at my house.
Oh, that's too bad.
In all seriousness, that's a big deal. Congratulations.
I'm way down that list. Now, that was a fun list, in fact, out in Scientific American this month. Not that I'm plugging it. I don't get...
Plug it.
But if you go look at the rest of the people, you'll say, well, thank goodness Art is on that list. Look at all the kooky craziness that the scientists are coming up with. They'll keep 10 ethicists busy for the rest of their lives. Very exciting group of folks, innovators, you know.
Oh, neat.
Lots of people on the cutting edge. So it was nice that they got an ethics person into the list because it's really the best of it is the rest of them are scientists.
Art Kaplan, let's call this first question an ethics/factual question. Jim mentioned about Donald Trump launching yet another attack on Mexico, saying that they're responsible for tremendous infectious diseases pouring over the border. Is that true?
Well, he's partly true. There are tremendous diseases pouring over the border, but it's anybody listening to Trump's broadcasts or statements in Mexico. He's disseminating mental illness at an enormously high rate. No, it isn't true. People are not bringing diseases from Mexico into the U.S., infectious diseases. In fact, there's no study, no evidence that any of that happens. The only place you really get outbreaks of infectious disease, say something like whooping cough or something, is when we institutionalize people at the border in close quarters and hold them for months without adequate hygiene. And we've had a little bit of disease outbreak there, but it's our doing. It's not the immigrant or the people trying to get in here.
I'm just purely guessing, but it would seem to me if you can endure the difficult traverse across, you know, these open lands for days. I mean, a lot of these people are in fairly good condition or they couldn't do it.
That's true. And I'm sure they're not in great shape at the end, but to make it,
exactly,
you've got to start out healthy. But the fact I love is this. The vaccination rate in Mexico is higher than in some communities in the U.S. So if you really wanted to avoid outbreaks of horrible infectious disease, you probably should stay out of Marin County and don't vaccinate.
Well, let's go to California and that the update on that in a second. Before you leave that for a second, Marjorie and I were looking for an ethical issue in this Trump thing, and we couldn't find one. We just wanted to talk about Donald Trump's latest. But there is an ethical issue. Is there an obligation on people in your profession, when there is a public health issue where information that's disseminated in a very high-profile fashion, which is anything that comes out of Donald Trump's mouth, is factually inaccurate and could cause problems on a variety of levels, is there any ethical obligation for people who do what you do or public information officers in healthcare facilities, whatever, to speak out and correct the misinformation, or is that a stretch?
No, I think there's a strong duty. I'm a little disappointed we haven't had a CDC or Surgeon General kind of, no, it's not true, Donald. We did get it. I don't know if you guys remember. This thing actually floated up around the Ebola outbreak. People were, some of our politicians were saying Ebola is coming to the U.S. through the border. Same mechanism, people sneaking in from Mexico. It wasn't true. In fact, there were no cases of Ebola in Mexico, so it was unlikely anybody would be bringing them here from there. But then the CDC did jump in, and they said it's just not true. There aren't any cases in Mexico. Whatever else is going on, they're not bringing Ebola over the border into the U.S. I haven't seen a similar thing here. I'm just wondering, you, Jim and Marjorie may know better than I do, is the government more reluctant to speak up because they think it's in the middle of a political campaign?
I would say yes.
Sides?
I would say yes, and it gives even higher profile, not that that's possible, to Donald Trump. I think so.
Yeah. I do remember that period of a day or two where people were really hysterical about ISIS coming here and purposely spreading Ebola in the United States. It sounds a little far-fetched to me.
Well,
but
to come back to your point, Marjorie, the reason that wasn't really plausible is if you had Ebola and you wanted to spread it coming across the desert in a two-week trip, I'm pretty sure you'd be dead before you got here to spread the Ebola.
Exactly. You do see these pictures of these people, and it is a grueling ordeal to get across the desert to get here. But anyway, let's move on to what you were just talking about, vaccines, because you wrote a great piece about this, talking about Jim Carrey, the actor, who is very funny, but maybe he should keep quiet about vaccinations. But nonetheless, he tweeted out to 14 million followers. He's upset that California has a tough new law on vaccinations, and he called the government, the new law, fascism, and you took him to task.
So I think Jim Carrey doesn't know anything about vaccines. He continues to spread the autism link, which is just bogus. In fact, there was a paper out this week that said if you looked at the placentas of women who just gave birth, you could start to see chemicals that were indicative of autism. So that's way before anybody gets vaccinated, when you're born, so to speak. So it's clear that the vaccine autism link just isn't the cause, and we got to start looking at other things. And Jim Carrey-type statements prevent us from looking at other things because they keep making people want to go back and re-examine the long-dead, beaten-down horse of the autism link to vaccination. So not good there, but he's a crummy political scientist, because here's what happened in California. They put in a bill to say, we're going to take away exemptions. We're going to restrict them. If you have a health reason, okay. But if you say you have a philosophical reason, meaning I don't like it, I don't want to vaccinate my kid before they go to school, or a religious reason, you're not going to be able to invoke those. And they basically debated it in the legislature, and then the governor thought about it for a while, and then he signed the bill. And so there's only health exemptions for school vaccinations. Kerry declared that fascism, I think that's called democracy.
Insight, I should read the tweet verbatim. California Gov says yes to poisoning more children with mercury and aluminum in mandatory vaccines. The corporate fascism must be stopped. And what did you say? He's got 14 million followers. Is that what you wrote or something like that?
14 million, yeah.
So it gets out there. Not quite as powerful as Dr. Oz, but he is in that category. Hey, you know, Art, we said to you a couple of minutes ago that we never missed an opportunity to talk about Donald Trump. We even rarer is an opportunity missed to talk about this woman. Here she is in August of 2013 talking about Obamacare's death panels.
Of course, there are death panels in there. It's in black and white in the law that there will be rationing of health care. They couldn't go forever in not acknowledging that, or they would look like complete buffoons, and they would be deemed incompetent, having not read the law to understand that death panels are a part of this atrocity.
Yeah, you don't know us from our commercial radio days. In our old days, we would play that 15 times in a row, but we can't do that.
I'm gonna miss her.
Well, is she right now? She was talking about the Affordable Care Act, but now it turns out that Medicare is doing something that critics are suggesting, or introducing something, I guess, that critics are saying is a variation on death panels. Are they right, and what's Medicare doing?
It's harder to be stupider than Donald Trump, but this actually achieved that very difficult bar to jump over. Of course you want people to talk about end-of-life care with their doctors. Of course you want doctors to raise it, not because we're trying to balance the national debt by saying, you know, Jim, have you thought about leaving us? Would you leave us sooner? Could you hurry it up? You're kind of expensive. Everybody's going to die. Everybody needs to plan for those events. Some of us will die unable to speak, and so it's nice to know who you want to make decisions for you. Some of us want everything. It's nice to write that down or let people know. Some of us want to die at home. Some of us want to go in the hospital, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. These are all part of reasonable, sound, ethical planning, and your physician can help you, presuming you've got one you trust and you can talk to, which I think is a bigger problem than having the conversation. So scaremongers and worrywarts were saying, even to bring this up, it's a death panel. Well, you know, it's not a death panel unless the death panel says you're going to have to die at a given time. The reality is we're all going to die, so there's only one big death panel. It's some guy with a big white beard up in the sky somewhere who's calling us, you know, to come back at some point, but we're all going to die. Americans, by the way, don't like to admit that. They like to think that death is an option. I know that, but it isn't true. We will all get there. I know that we all think we can kind of kale and alfalfa our way to an eternal existence, but that's not so. So in any event, really good to do it. And all the bill is trying to do is say encourage the conversations by giving doctors a little bit more money to spend more time with you. Everybody knows that, you know, medical visits are rushed and the doctor's got a lot of data to enter into computer programs, and often he or she has their head stuck in the machine and isn't even making eye contact. This would just set up a little more incentive and say, here's a bit of money, spend some time, go through this, check the boxes, say that you did it. And let me add one last thing. If you don't want to do it, don't do it. I mean, I'm encouraging you to do it, but there's nothing here that says you have to have the conversation. It just makes it optional.
You know, Art Kaplan, you've mentioned the word conversation several times, and this is my opportunity to give a free plug to something which I think is really, and I'm sure you know about this.
Yeah.
Ellen Goodman, former longtime Boston Globe columnist, started this thing called the Conversation Project, and where people, and you can download it for free online, and it enables you to have the conversation with your own parents or your own spouse or within your family about end-of-life things, and you answer all these questions, and then you sit down and discuss it with your family. And it's really terrific. I went to one of these sessions last fall with my second job for Crux at the Globe. It's a Catholic website talking about end-of-life issues. And it's terrific. Nobody wants to have the conversation. You're right. But it's good to have it.
Yeah. And I think they do a great job. And they're sort of a private initiative to get the conversation going. But I think it's fair to make it part of public policy, to make it something the government encourages us to do. Remember, I'll say it again, you don't have to go to this conversation and say, you know, as soon as I get sick, just because we owe a lot of money and the banks have a lot of debt, let me go, don't spend anything on me. I mean, you could ask for everything. You could say, I want a full bore press. You can say whatever you want. So it isn't a situation where people, that death panel notion, when you have the conversation, say, with Ellen Goodman's group or try to encourage it with doctors, I think people come to the conclusion it means don't give me anything or give me less. That doesn't have to be so. You can say what you want. You can lay out your values, whatever they are, about how you want to die. But in talking about it, you do the most important thing possible is let other people know about your values. If you're the only one who knows them and you can't speak, trust me, they're not going to be acted upon.
You know, Art, that whole time you were talking and trying to figure out another way to play Sarah Palin again, I couldn't, so we're going to unfortunately have to move on to the next topic. This is something that I've been a big advocate for a long time, and I'm nervous about raising it because I'm afraid you're going to say I'm wrong, and I don't want to be. The New England Journal of Medicine is out talking about these programs that essentially pay incentives directly to people if they are willing to change their behavior or health patterns, whether you know smoking, losing weight, that sort of stuff. I am a huge advocate of this, even though I know that when you stop the incentive, it's likely that you go back to your old bad habits. Where are you on this?
They make me nervous a little bit. I don't mind carrots. I'm not as crazy about sticks. So if you want to incentivize behavior and you can really show that people will respond, great. It turns out people usually say, well, I'm going to give you an extra $3 a week if you stop smoking. And to get you to stop smoking, you're really going to have to give me like $100 a week. We don't respond to something that's fun and pleasurable and a bad habit unless you really make it worthwhile. So one of the problems is it sounds good, but the fiscal incentives are usually pretty big to get you to stop doing fun stuff, so to speak. You know, it's sort of candy bars versus I'm going to give you an extra dollar a month, and I suspect the candy bars will win. The other problem is sometimes this is done in the workplace, and then your boss is kind of turned into your health nag.
Yeah, that part I have a problem with. I agree with that.
And, it, you know, it's just weird. The boss doesn't say, gee, you're getting migraines because we're keeping you here, you know, like they do at WGBH, 20 hours a day in slave-type conditions. No water, no nothing. It's like crossing the desert from Mexico. And so they don't care about that because they want you to work hard and, you know, that. And they're perfectly willing to say, lose some weight because it doesn't cost them anything. You know, my point is sometimes the workplace can be the source of ill health or stress or tension, but those programs never get going. They're more on the lose weight and smoking end. There's nothing wrong about that. But then, again, your employer, how much do you want them really getting into the lifestyle you lead issue? Do you really want them starting to say, you know, gee, Jim, you're just golfing. Why don't you take up running? That really would be better for you, in my opinion, as your boss. And it's sort of like, you know, I'll talk to my doctor about that. I don't need to.
Yeah, but can I get back to the larger? I totally agree with you. I have the same angst about the employer knowing or involvement and that sort of thing. But when you talk about the size of the incentive has to be significant enough, I assume what I'm about to say is true and then some. If the incentives, for example, to stop smoking or to lose weight are large, these insurance companies save huge amounts of money in the long run. It's far better to spend, I'm making it up, $1,000 a month or $100 a week to say stop smoking, and if you do, I'll pay you $100 a week, than it is to pay for the costs that are likely to accrue if you smoke for 20 years, right?
Yep. You definitely will save money. There is an irony, a tiny one. You're going to love this. If I can get you to not wear a motorcycle helmet and do things that kill you when you're very young, I can probably save money that way too, because then you don't accrue all the healthcare costs across a lifespan. So that notion of, live hard, die young kind of thing, that has its economic advantages. If you can come up with overdoses and traumatic injuries that end your life when you're 22, gunshot. If you're a cruel economist, and note I am not one, I am an ethicist, but if you're a raw economist, you sort of say, boy, that's the best way. Live a couple of decades, drop dead, get out of here fast, no accumulated expenses. So presuming we all think that's insane, the next best thing is live healthy and then stave off all those emphysema costs, diabetes costs, and all the rest of it. That's the second best thing.
You know, speaking of smoking, just as a quick aside for a second, we rarely praise major American corporations. I want to praise CVS for the second time. One, as we've discussed, I think, with you, is the first major drugstore change, last year or something, to stop selling tobacco, even though they're making a ton of money on it. They have now withdrawn from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce following, I think it was the New York Times story last week, where it's clear that the chamber and its foreign affiliates are lobbying globally against anti-smoking laws. That's a big deal, isn't it?
Big deal. You know, one of the ways big tobacco has survived and flourished is to export cigarette smoking and the habit to other countries. China has a huge smoking problem. We're down here and kind of level, but they're growing fast, and so are many, many other countries around the world. Internationally, the Chamber of Commerce, this business association, lobbies against efforts to restrict smoking. The things we see here about no restaurant smoking, different bans and restrictions on where you can smoke, and packaging of cigarettes with scary, awful images of what it does to your body, and age restrictions. They fight that stuff overseas. So CVS finally said, we won't play ball with that. Now, you can be cynical and say, CVS is beginning to position itself more than a drugstore, more than a place where you buy batteries. It's going to move, as you can see with its vaccination stuff, into the health space. Yeah. You know, you're going to go there for more.
Yeah.
But you know what I say? Good.
I'm with you.
That's nice. Sometimes you can make a living doing good things, and so I'm there. I agree. I think that's very commendable.
We're talking with Art Kaplan, our medical ethicist. We want you to know we don't fool around here at WGBH. She's just been named one of the 100 most influential people in biotech by the Scientific American. So, Art, let's move on to this story about the cops in Los Angeles, which I found fascinating. That what they're doing is when they are in the process of making an arrest, they do a mental health evaluation. They give an example of some guy who seemed very confused. He was talking to himself. He's inside the bank, acting very odd. And the officer on the scene tries to find out what's wrong with him. And instead of arresting him, if they conclude he's got some mental health issues, they triage him and basically send him to a mental health treatment facility. This sounds brilliant to me.
It's absolutely the right way to go. It's a baby step. The good news is getting that referral, I think, makes absolute sense. The bad news is the system that follows it isn't very good, so you can send them over to mental health, but they're likely to get held for 72 hours and kicked. We don't really have a good follow-up program for the mentally ill. We've been cutting in that area for a long time. So here's a quick quiz for both of you.
What?
The two biggest mental health providers in the United States institutions are?
Jails.
Prisons.
Jails.
What's
exactly
this?
Right.
Yeah.
Second
Cook
one?
County Jail, L.A. County Jail. Two biggest mental health providers. Jails.
I thought you were going to say Trump campaign headquarters, but I assume that's third. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I'm sure that's a lonely place, by the way.
You know,
so,
but
go ahead. I'm sorry.
The fact is that if you looked out in our prisons, we didn't deinstitutionalize the mentally ill. We moved them from asylums into prisons and jails. They're still institutionalized. You can make an argument that they're not better off than, you know, in the olden days when they were in asylums like Bridgewater or Byberry outside of Philly. You know, we moved them. We never made provision to take care of them. So I have a lot of empathy for the cops. They're on the front line. They see it. I know we spend a lot of time arguing about the use of force and all that, but cops basically spend a lot of their time as kind of social workers, and they have to make decisions about, you know, the mental status of people. We got to train them better to do that, better to deal with the mentally ill. Remember our friend, the I can't breathe guy?
Yes, Eric Garner.
He wasn't in this category of, you know, we don't really need to arrest him. We've got to kind of get him some help kind of person. And so, I have a lot of empathy for trying to make those decisions on the fly. Tough, tough job, very humanitarian in a lot of ways to be a policeman that way. But they need a system, the mentally ill do, to back up those referrals, and just rotating them around from prison to jail to the street is not a system.
You know, Art Kaplan, we've been talking about the inadequacy of the mental health system for years and years and years. And there's these stories all the time here in Massachusetts. And Massachusetts is pretty progressive, as you know, where there's not enough beds for teenagers. You find there's something really wrong with the teenager. There's no overnight place to send the teen, this kind of thing. Is there any constituency is there any hope that this is going to change? And also, as you probably know, a lot of psychiatrists don't even take insurance. A lot of therapists don't even take insurance. So it's almost like you got to be wealthy to get mental health care.
It is. And I think it's true. And I think, you know, we tried to see more parity established under the health reform to give mental health benefits more priority. And that's good. But we don't have enough providers, and we don't have enough services, and so that's where the gap is. And I think the only way we're going to really get after that is to say we've got to expand social work, we've got to expand psychology. It isn't going to be a field run by psychiatrists. There aren't enough of them, and it isn't lucrative enough. Most medical students aren't going to go in that direction. The interesting news, though, is we're getting some better drugs. We're starting to understand the brain. You know, we have all these scans and imaging things going on, starting to say, oh, look at that. That's schizophrenia, and that really is depression. So I think the field's going to make some progress, but I think we've got to add the manpower, and that's probably going to be giving more incentives to say, yeah, you know, you can make a good living and have a good career as a psychologist or social worker. That's where the mental health system has got to go.
All right, Kaplan, what's on the podcast?
So this week... I'm going back to something because I still can't believe it. We're going to lead off with, it's beyond me, that Texas Agriculture Commissioner, he got the French fries and the deep fryer back into the Texas school system. He won. They're back.
What side are you on that?
So I think Donald Trump should take his meals in Texas high school cafeterias and then patrol the border for disease-infected illegals.
Can I tell you, if you think you're ever making Scientific American's top 100 list when Donald Trump is president, you're out of your mind. Art, it's great to talk to you.
Congratulations
on your being
picked for that impressive list. Thank you, Art. Art Kaplan joins us every Wednesday. He's head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics podcast, and he's just been named among the 100 most influential people in biotechnology by Scientific American, which is pretty good. Art Kaplan, thanks again. Coming up, we're asking you, can you look cool while keeping cool when it comes to warm weather? Can you draw the line where you want to when it comes to what you're going to wear to beat the heat? Like, can you wear a short sleeve suit? That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.